This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Sam Fussell was a short, skinny kid who, when adolescence hit, became a tall and skinny teenager. He was a bookish student. He graduated with honors from Oxford University with a degree in English literature. His parents are intellectuals. His father, Paul Fussell, is a noted literary critic, and his mother, Betty Fussell, is a writer. Sam Fussell grew up in a world that valued intellect over athletics. When he graduated from college and left the protected walls of academia, he moved to New York City and became consumed by his fears of urban life. What he did to make himself feel invulnerable was become a bodybuilder. He spent 4 years, 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, pumping iron. He turned himself into a larger-than-life muscle man and nearly killed himself in the process. Fussell's written a memoir about those obsessive years called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. When we spoke, I asked him what made him so unlikely.
How many 6'4", 250-pound, Oxford-educated, steroid-addicted bodybuilders do you know who live next door?
And is it the brains and the brawn? I mean, is that what makes you different from bodybuilders?
Well, I am not that different from bodybuilders. I think most bodybuilders even aren't that different from most other human beings. People regard bodybuilding as a subject so extreme, so irrational, that they have no clue why anyone would do that. But if you think about it, it's really not that irrational at all. Bodybuilding is about embracing a so-called lifestyle, in mm-hmm. which we all do as human beings. The clothes you wear, the furniture you buy for your apartment, the house you drive, the home you buy or the apartment you buy, they're all emblems of the self. Who but a bodybuilder knows about projecting that self and foisting it upon the rest of the world?
Well, reading your book, and I understand exactly what you're saying, but at the same time, the extreme obsession, and you really write about the obsession of bodybuilding, I think does make it slightly different than other people who are as egocentric and narcissistic as everybody else. But this obsession and this focus on body is different.
The focus on body is different. I don't think the obsession's different. Take a man who makes money. Money and muscles, very similar. Two incremental self-measures of worth. In bodybuilding, the difference is that your body is everything. Mm-hmm. In money, it's not everything. It becomes, in a man's obsession or a woman's obsession for it, it can become everything. But in bodybuilding, it's all body.
Is there any way to be a bodybuilder and not be obsessed about it?
Not an incredibly successful one, no. On the other hand, if you want to be Donald Trump, don't expect to have a nice home life. Mm-hmm. Huge sacrifices have to be made if you're going to be successful at just about anything.
You talk about it, or other people talk about it, and this is kind of in the beginning of your career as a bodybuilder, the disease. I mean, that's the phrase you use. Why?
The disease I call a complete commitment to all matters pertaining to iron, not just lifting weights, but reading about them. The food you eat, it's all bodybuilding food, protein powders, amino packs. The hours you sleep, you have to get 10 or 12 good hours a night. The jobs you take, you work as a personal trainer in order to work out in the morning, work out at night. It's all emblems of the disease.
Did you feel when you were bodybuilding that you had a disease, or did you have another way of explaining
it? Oh, absolutely, I felt I had a disease. People don't realize that much about bodybuilding is camp. It is artifice raised to an amazing extreme so that bodybuilders chuckle at themselves. Most of the best bodybuilders in the world realize, on the one hand, they've developed a carapace of armor, which is really menacing to other human beings. On the other hand, many of the best ones realize this is absurd. It's a hilarious parody of what it means to be a man. But as long as that's it, let's play with it.
You say that you, after graduating from Oxford University, moved to New York City, found yourself really frightened. I mean, frightened by the city. What do you think was so scary?
I felt absolutely under siege. I felt absolutely out of control. For 7 years, I'd been at college, and every day all I did was read and study, and that's what I loved. I was sequestered in a little lonely room, and I was absolutely rewarded for it academically. As soon as I came out of college and decided, well, I don't really know if I want to become a college professor or not, I was in New York City, I was working at a job I didn't particularly like, and I no longer had any emblems of status. I didn't have any money. I had a sublet apartment. I had nothing, I felt, including no self-control.
You describe yourself, you're tall, and you were always had been a kind of skinny, tall kid.
Yeah, Tony Perkins lookalike.
What made you think, and you really talk about seeing a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's interesting to me that you hadn't seen pictures of bodybuilders before, but there was something, even a moment, in a bookstore where you said, that's my solution. That's the solution to my problem.
I did think that. I looked at that kind of body, and I thought, what could possibly perturb this man? Here are muscles in the shape of mountains on that body. His biceps are biceps, too, but they're also bulging Mount Everest biceps. First of all, how does a guy like that buy clothes? That was an immediate interest. Right. And then second of all, how could a guy like that possibly be hurt by anything or anyone? How could someone like that feel humiliated if his girlfriend told him, God, I really don't like you very much? Would he cry? I don't think so. Not the kind of Arnold I projected.
So you were seeing the muscles as a kind of suit of armor. Interesting, both against the kind of physical world, but also against the hurts of the emotional
Certainly.
World.
Think of a lobster's carapace. There's a great red lobster, and he's formed by medieval armor. I wanted something which was absolutely impermeable, which would not let other people touch me. I wanted to be, let's use a cartoon image for a cartoon world. I wanted to be a fortress of solitude. I wanted Superman's private preserve, where I could impress everyone a great deal, but inside not be touched.
Tell us about the first time you went into a weight room. What did you see?
I saw a great dichotomy, right, a split right down the middle of the room. On the one side of the room were the men, most of them scrawny number two pencil necks, who used the universal weight machines and the Nautilus machines. On the other side were the free weight sector group, a rowdy, absolute camouflage-wearing band of men who wore T-shirts that said things like, don't bark if you can't growl.
Was there anything enjoyable about that first day?
The enjoyable thing was I started. I'd done it. It's like a boxer finally getting into the ring. Okay, like the first day of school. Great trepidation involved, but finally you've done it.
Well, I'll say that my small smile here is just that when I walk by a Nautilus room at a you know, an aerobics place, and I see people, men and women, sweating out there, I look in and I say, I don't understand. I don't understand the attraction. I don't understand what brings these people to this room over and over and over again.
One of the reasons is sex. If you don't like to go to bars, you can go to gyms and you can find people who you might well want to take home and make love with.
Although you describe in your years of building yourself up that you actually didn't have a lot of girlfriends. I mean, it seemed as if sex took a real backseat to your own body. I guess your own body was more important than another person's body.
It was. I tell people that my process in the gym was a matter of de-evolution. I started off as just simple Sam, who I am. That then changed to Samson. Took about 30 pounds in 2 years. I became Samson, who was muscle man. Mm. Samson was okay for about 2 years more, 30 more pounds, till I was about 240. Then I was Samosaurus, a half-man, half-dinosaur hybrid. From there, I finally became a He-Man Masters of the Universe life-action doll, and I was recognized as such by school children on a playground. I was tanning before my last contest. They came up to me. I heard whispering above me. My eyes were closed. I felt the sun on my back, and then I heard the word, Skeletor! He's Skeletor! As if I was a life-action doll. I became a He-Man doll in such a way that the only women eventually I was interested in dating were she-women, ditzy, girly-girl equivalents of my masculine image.
You actually have a funny but sort of a sad scene of yourself and a woman bodybuilder whose name just escaped me. You can say
G-Spot. Are we allowed to say that on the air?
How could I have forgotten? Were you actually, we don't need to get too graphic here, but tried to make love with her, and it was as if, and it was a pretty funny description about these two, I guess she people, trying to embrace. I mean, it was almost like, you know, iron lip against iron lip.
Yeah, think of the Monitor and the Merrimack during the Civil War, two great ironclad vessels that were very much about menace and not much about anything else. We embraced. I kissed her and found a mustache hairier than my own.
My guess is Samuel Fussell, and as he just told you, he went to Oxford University, and a number of years ago, when he moved to New York City, he became a bodybuilder, kind of lost himself into the world of bodybuilding, and he's just written a book about those experiences. It's called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. You talk about the kind of simplicity of building your body up. Not that it doesn't take a long time and there isn't a lot of discipline involved, but there is this kind of cause and effect. I mean, if you do this, then you're going to get some muscles where you want them. Were you attracted to that? And you mentioned the control, the idea that you could go into this room and for once be in some control over your life.
I loved it. I loved the fact that not only was it about reinvention as a human being, but it was also about something which you don't often find in the workplace. In the workplace, you can be very diligent, very industrious, and work 75-hour weeks and be incredibly competent at your job, but it doesn't guarantee promotion. Your boss might not like you or might be sleeping with someone who's working with you who's incompetent and promote them. The gym isn't like that. You put in the time, you eat right, you diet properly, you put in your hours, you get stronger, and you get bigger. It absolutely works.
It was interesting, and I was reading an article, I think, that your mother wrote about you as you were building your body up, and this was an article in Lear's magazine, and she said that the larger you got, the smaller that she felt. What effect did this have on your parents, who I will add are both, I guess, college professors, considered to be part of the intellectual crowd, we can say that?
Well, on one hand, my mother was disgusted. I remember submitting my tape of Pumping Iron, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, to her, and she said, "This is disgusting of these men. These men have tits." And I tried to explain to her mother, this is physical development. She said, "Yes, and meanwhile, they're functionally illiterate." So she hated that side of it, and she thought that I was becoming a beast. But
this gets back to your idea about I guess, growing up in an intellectual family. It seems that bodybuilding would be the opposite of what your family wanted for you.
It was, but I always realized that I could do something in bodybuilding. I also knew that Hunter Thompson had written a book called Hell's Angels, which I loved, and I knew that no one had written a book on bodybuilding and that I could do it. I knew I'd have to live it, but that was fine because I loved living it. I thought, okay, if I bodybuild for the next 50 years, I'm never going to stop writing books. I'll always be able to get books out of it.
Sam Fussell is my guest. His book about his 4-year obsession with bodybuilding is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Samuel Wilson Fussell, and he's just written a book called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder, and it's about his years building up his body and the people he met, the experiences he had, and some of the psychological involvements with this whole process that he went through. As you were building up your body, tell us what your life was like. I mean, how did you spend your day? And I guess we're still in New York now.
Yeah, in New York, I started still holding a job. I thought I was naive enough to believe that I was capable of holding a 9-to-5 job and work out as a bodybuilder. That soon changed. The demands are very high, and I realized that after about 6 months of not getting any sleep, that I had to choose. People become Mr. Olympias not by holding down full-time jobs, but by becoming full-time bodybuilders. So immediately I realized after the first few months I would have to eat differently, and that included 5,000 to 7,500 calories a day. It included 10 raw eggs a day. It included all kinds of chicken breasts, pounds of meat. Unbelievable.
And that's expensive. I mean, if you're going to...
It is expensive. That's why you don't have girlfriends when you do it, because you can't afford to take them out on dates.
Well, how much would you spend a week on food? I mean,
I'd say about $200 a week. For an individual person. And then if you're making, as I was at, I won't say where, $13,000 a year, you can't afford anything else other than your rent.
So how do you support yourself?
Then you become a personal trainer. You move to California and train the wacky and the weird, which is just what I did.
You talk about the walk. I mean, the bodybuilder's walk. And I think we know what that looks like, those of us that have seen bodybuilders. How did your attitude or even your persona change? How did you become this person you were inventing for yourself?
Yeah, it's a very complex question. It gets down to Norman Mailer's Advertisements for Myself. I learned the walk from my two friends, gym friends, Sweepy and Mousy, and I realized from the beginning it was a fantastic way to become living theater, to be animated motion of what it means to be menacing.
And for people that aren't familiar with the walk, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as that particular weightlifter's waddle known among the bodybuilding cognoscenti. The thighs are flared outward to prevent inner thighs chafing because the thighs are so big.
Right.
The arms are swept way out to the side because the massivity of your lats or your back necessitates, presumably in theory, that your elbows be as high up as your shoulders. So you look like an enormous turkey with his breast way out strutting as a peacock around the world.
You also look like, and I'm not trying to insult you here, but you look like a pinhead. I mean, the odd thing I find about bodybuilders is that the body gets built up, but you can't add to the to the head.
Oh, and bodybuilders love that. They want their head to look absolutely tiny. I was actually called in the gym Zippy the Pinhead because my shoulders got so big, my head looked like a pea balanced on the middle of a ruler.
But why? I mean, what's
because
beautiful
this isn't about it? This isn't about the glorification of the head or the mind. This is about head decapitation. If you want to look like the Belvedere Apollo, you don't care what's above the neck. You just care what's down. Bodybuilders, many of them pride themselves in not being so good looking. Lots of people can inherit cheekbones. Very few people can make muscles. That's the way they view it.
How easy was it to get steroids?
It was as easy as asking. But steroids are an enormous controversy right now, and unfortunately, steroids are here to stay. The problem now is that we've developed for ourselves a ludicrous situation in which everyone is forced to lie. The competitors are forced to risk their health, and everyone else profits other than some of the competitors. Take in track and field a meat promoter. The meat promoter wants to make money. To make money, you want world records set, or else you're not going to get a full house. To set world records, it helps for the athletes to take every advantage they can in order to get those world records, which have been broken on steroids anyway. So it's a huge vicious cycle.
What then did steroids do for you? Where did steroids take you?
Steroids took me faster than I would have gone without them. They got me what I wanted. What I wanted to do was to compete and to become a bodybuilder and do it as fast as possible. It took me 4 years to look like one of the guys in the magazines. It takes most people 8 or 10 years.
And were you getting double doses?
I was getting, there are no double doses because there's no norm. If you're alive and you're taking steroids, you're succeeding. That's the way the bodybuilding people think it. If your system's capable of taking it, then keep on taking it. It's amazing how much people pack it in.
And the side effects? How did you deal with those?
The side effects I had were acne. I did have a ton of that. I did have rectal bleeding. I had tons of nosebleeds. But the thing about steroids is there are no guarantees. There are thousands of people who have taken them with seemingly no side effects, or side effects like acne, which they view as something purely temporary. The side effects I had were purely temporary. When I went off, the side effects went off.
It's interesting to me that you wanted to build your body up, and yet you didn't mind it covered with acne. I don't want to get obsessed on this, but that's an interesting.
I'll tell you why.
Okay.
When you bodybuild and you are covered with acne, you don't see it on stage because you buy for $25 a quart. You buy gallon jugs of fake tan. As long as you cover yourself with this veneer, the judges can't see the acne. The only people you really want to care about you are the judges in the bodybuilding shows. Providing you look, you can look like Moby Dick off-season, being a tremendous fat man. But you might not care unless for 90 seconds a year when you're on stage, the judges don't see you as a fat man.
My guest is Samuel Fussell. His book is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. It's about his years building up his body and the world of bodybuilding, and also for him, some of the psychological issues that he was struggling with as he was creating this, as you say, this kind of suit of armor for yourself. When did you want to, was the goal then of all this to compete? I mean, is that the goal, that was the goal for you from the beginning?
Yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger had won Mr. Universe in 5 years. Yeah. I thought, okay, if he's done it in 5 years, if I work as hard as anyone who's ever worked at this, why can't I do it in 5 or maybe 4? And by the time I'd done 4, the next year I would have done the Mr. America show, and the logical sequence from that is doing the Mr. Universe show. And I realized after my 4th year, forget it. If this is what it means to do it, I don't want it. I want to be a human being. I don't want to be superhuman.
Well, how did your routine change as you then went into competition?
It's called the contest countdown, where you break down everything in the day in order to win in a contest. So my diet changed from going from 7,500 calories a day to just 1,000 calories a day. For a 260-pound man, 1,000 calories a day or 750 calories a day is a matter of rice cakes and water. That's eating almost nothing.
So your body's starting to eat itself.
Oh, that's the whole point. It does eat itself. But providing it eats its fat first and not its muscle, then you're fine on stage. The problem once you're on stage is that you have so little energy left that while you're swiveling and growling and preening and posing, you're about to collapse and black out because you're so dizzy. But the point isn't to be healthy inside. It's to look like the image of self-health to the judges. It's also about to look like you're in control.
At one point, and this is really at the very end of your career, you got your, I guess you were eating about 630 calories a day. I mean, this was sort of training for the big event.
Yeah.
And you could hardly even make it to the event. I mean, you were so
weak. I could literally not even walk. I spent I did two contests in 2 weeks. There was a 1 week break between each. In the first contest, I was about 8 pounds overweight, and I realized it on stage. I won the show. I won my weight class, but I was a little hefty. And in bodybuilding circles, they call it smoother than a glass mirror. Mm. You couldn't see enough veins, the vascularity look that's prized among bodybuilders. So I realized I needed to lose at least 8 to 10 pounds. So in 6 days, I lost 12 pounds. And I did that by sitting on the sofa or lying down on the sofa, practically comatose, and not eating a great deal, eating almost all down to 500 calories a day. I was so weak, I couldn't even practice my posing. I couldn't get up. I didn't go to the bathroom for the whole week because my body was feeding on itself.
Do you think you were losing your mind?
No, I think I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. And that's what it took to do it. For people to think that bodybuilders don't do that, bodybuilders are lying when they say they don't do that because they're trying to sell their product to the public. They're trying to say, oh, this is great. It's about health. Ha!
And where did your muscles go? You still have some. I mean, I can see that.
They atrophied. And another muscle cliche, you don't lose it, you lose it. Mm. And the hard part is if you've been evolving and you see yourself evolving from a 17-inch collar to an 18 to a 20, all of a sudden you go back down to an 18 to a 17 and you're wearing the same shirts you were wearing 5 or 6 years ago. The trick is thinking, gosh, I hope I'm not the same person I was 6 years ago. And you're not. But if you just lead your life according to measurements and inches, then that's where you're always going to be. It's an endless rut.
I'm curious where then the pain that drove you to this sense of feeling afraid in the world, of feeling vulnerable, what happened to that?
I decided to face it.
Did you?
I got so tired of erecting the proscenium and the facade. It was Baroque. It was Rococo. It was so complex. It was such stage scenery. I spent so many hours per day hoisting it and working the ratchets and the levers. I didn't want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather just face it. If it means having to be humiliated and having to bear insults, fine. I'm willing to do that. Just don't force me to go to the weight room and make me mouth the cliches and look like Superman. Don't want to do that anymore.
And you still work out some?
I won't work out for 6 months at a time. If I have to let off some steam, I'll go in, renew old acquaintances, and do a few times a week. But I'm no longer a prisoner to it, thank God. And I love those who do. I love to watch it. I just don't want to be one of them anymore.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Sam Fussell's book is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.